Okay. Hi, I am Brian Cardell. I am a developer advocate at Egalia.
And I'm Eric Meyer, also a developer advocate at Egalia. And this week we're going to be talking about just stuff that's caught our attention recently. For me, that'll be mostly CSS. I think Brian has more of a mix of things that have interested him. Things that the working group has been discussing or has been deciding recently. Like one of my favorites that's been a topic of discussion over a few working group meetings is, what is a hairline? So the idea is that...
And how many angels could dance on it?
How many hairlines can we get on the head of a P tag? Anyway, you have border widths of, you know, thin, medium, thick, or whatever. And so there's this idea of being able to have a hairline border. And there was some discussion about maybe we should have a hairline unit. So you could have something be two hairlines thick or three hairlines thick. But that really led to the question of, okay, but how thick is a hairline? And like one of the proposals was, well, it should be like one hairline thickness should be one device pixel. Not a CSS reference pixel, but a literal, like, actual display device pixel, which these days can be incredibly thin. And so there was some concern about, well, maybe that's too thin. And then, okay, well, if we're not going to just go with device pixels, which could lead to very different results across different devices, right? If you have a low pixel embedded device, then maybe a hairline on that looks much thicker than it does on an iPhone or whatever.
I guess there's also a question of whether that's a bug or a feature of that approach.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's part of the discussion. But it sort of captured one of those interesting things about being involved in CSS discussions is sometimes you have these discussions that are surprisingly difficult to come to a resolution on. And I use resolution here intentionally because, you know, you could define a hairline very simply to be a device, you know, like a hairline width line is just one row of device pixels, which could be in some cases a device so high resolution that you can barely see it no matter how high the contrast is. And in other devices, it's very obvious. But if you're not going to do that, that's sort of the simplest approach to take. If you're not going to do that, if you're going to say, well, we want hairlines to be sort of consistently visible, then you're back to the, like, how big is a reference pixel, except now it's a smaller reference pixel. That discussion is still ongoing. If people are interested in joining in with their thoughts on how a hairline should behave across devices and across display surfaces and what you think of as hairline, how you might use it, we'll have a link in the show notes to that issue about hairline and contribute to that discussion because it's not settled. It's still being mooted about, you know, for that matter, would you find real usefulness in being able to say, I want this thing to be two hairlines thick, but I want this other thing to be five hairlines thick? Because my recollection is that in the discussion, nobody could really come up with a good use case for that.
I would like to say at the beginning of this episode that, like, I have been like semi-checked out of CSS working group for the last like month or so. And so I'm catching up here just like you. So,
yeah, well, and I'll be catching up on some of the things that I think you want to talk about.
I'd love to have people also just write in and tell us, do you want that?
Yeah, I mean, there's that as well. There's certainly the position to be made of, you know, we shouldn't be wasting our time on this, like as an industry or for that matter as a working group.
Very difficult because, you know, frequently it involves similar people. I mean, certainly the whole working group has to spend time listening, even if it's like to mostly go, sure, I guess we trust the editor.
Right.
Or we trust the three or four people who are going to talk about this. But very often, the primary inputs are the same three, four, or five people. And if they're doing that, then they're not maybe doing something else.
Yeah, and they're not doing something else. So, yeah, it would be tricky. Interesting to hear from people. Yeah, to see, it's like, do you even care? Like, yeah. Does this really strike you as a angels on the head of a pin kind of discussion? Or as soon as you heard like hairline width lines, you were like, yes, that is absolutely a thing that I would love to use. Let us know. Anyway.
Yeah.
Another thing that caught my eye recently, although it's not as recent a topic, was item flow. So listeners probably are familiar with the discussions around Grid and Flexbox, and then there's been Masonry layout. We had Rachel Andrew on a few episodes ago to talk about the two sort of viewpoints at that time, which was there was a viewpoint that Masonry should be part of Grid layout, so sort of like a special kind of Grid layout. And then there was a view that it should be a special kind of Flexbox layout, or that maybe it should be its own thing. And now there's been a proposal, I read about it in the WebKit blog, basically saying, well, what if we didn't make it really part of either, but we specified item flow? So we have Flex items and Grid items, but we could talk about item flow. And by having certain properties and value combinations, we could get Masonry style behavior actually kind of out of either Flex or Grid, depending on exactly what kind of Masonry behavior you want. And I just thought that was really interesting. I actually wrote a blog post.
I was just going to say, you wrote a really nice blog post on this, actually.
Yeah.
Link to that as well.
My first blog post in a while. But yeah, we can throw that in the show notes. And the link to the original WebKit blog post, which goes into more detail than mine did. But yeah, it's really interesting how that discussion of, well, do we do it this way or do we do it that way, might, and let's be clear, might yield this new way of doing things that actually sort of harmonizes, or it brings together Flex and Grid. So they, instead of being very separate things, they actually start to become different expressions of this item flow idea. So yeah, it's, if you have any interest in Masonry layout, which has been a wish list item for a lot of designers for years, and there have been, you know, polyfills and JavaScript libraries and such to make it possible with a minimum of scripting. Look into it more and see what you think. I feel like, and I said this in my blog post, that their item flow might actually make multi-call, sort of like subsume multi-column layout. I think you can just do multi-column layout and different kinds of multi-column layout and more powerful multi-column layout using item flow and not actually having to use the columns property anymore. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I'm like 90% sure that should work. So yeah, it's just, it's an interesting possibility. It's there's some tantalizing ideas there.
This thing that you're saying, like, we had a perfectly good proposal for Masonry back in 2019 or something like that. And a few people were like, but it kind of, maybe it's more like this. And then, you know, that spent some time developing, and then after some time, it was like, but maybe it's more like this. And I do think that, like, each time it gets better. But I also do accept and recognize that sometimes it can be circular. And there's this, like, tension with, like, when do you just ship it? You know, like, when do you go, we will probably always have ways to tweak this, but at some point we need to ship the thing, you know? And so, yeah, like, this is an interesting to me example, because I agree with you that, like, what we're talking about here looks actually way more interesting. It's like this way to, like, unify the things, which is a common thing that happens when we sit on something long enough. It's like a bunch of people start to notice, well, oh, this and this and this and this, they're all very similar. Like, maybe we can unify them So yeah, I agree. It's that your last one there is really interesting, the item flow. But I don't know what you think about that comment about, you know, like how long do we sit on it? Because I bet if we sit on it for another 2 or 3 years debating or fighting about it, we'll come up with something that we'll be like, oh yeah, that's even better. You know, like,
yeah, I mean,
that's variables is like this in a way. It went through many, many, many versions until finally Tab Adkins came up with this, like, what if they're really basically just custom properties, you know?
Right.
And then that was like, yeah, that's the one thing that nobody else can do. Only custom properties could do that. So yeah, we like that. And I think it's been great, right? Like, it's been really great.
Yeah. I mean, yes, if you let something marinate for long enough, it will, the flavor profile will change many times. and yeah, I mean, given enough time, you can eventually get to a much better solution. But yeah, there is always that question of, okay, but how long is too long? When do we actually ship? And yeah, who knows? Right now, item flow looks like it's good enough that it could ship to me, but it also hasn't really been subjected to a huge amount of scrutiny, I feel like. It, you know, I'm always looking for the community to come and say, okay, well, how would I do X with this system? Or this is how I think I would do this with this system. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes that leads to, oh no.
Actually, yeah,
we can't do that, and that's a problem. Or that's not how you would do it, but you would do it this other way. But it's interesting that you thought it was this way. Look, you know, right? Those sorts of things. So, you know, much like with the hairline, if people are interested in that idea or hate that idea, would really like to see them contribute to that discussion. A good enough proposal hopefully will stand up to scrutiny, and a not good enough proposal will yield to that scrutiny and become a better proposal. That's, of course, the ideal. Whether that always happens is another question.
Yeah.
But that's what we're always aiming for, right?
And I would say the observation that you made about, like, sometimes somebody brings along a use case and they're like, oh, no, you can't do that. I would say you're underselling that, because, like, in my experience, it's not sometimes. It's, like, pretty much all the time. Like, the more people you have going, okay, I would like to use this, and quickly realizing that they can't for the thing that they thought they could.
Right.
And they get feedback back into the system sooner rather than later. That's always a good thing, right? Because you can prevent design mistakes. You can, you know, short circuit bad problems and things like that. So yeah. Anyway, we can link to those two things. What else you got on your list of...
I think we're actually going to link to a lot of things, but you just mentioned custom properties. Tab Adkins sort of had that solution for doing variables in CSS. One of the things that got published recently, first public working draft of custom functions, which...
I'm excited about that.
Okay. Tell me why.
It's actually, you know, how I got into the CSS working group in the first place. Is because I was frustrated by the fact that there were things that I wanted in CSS, but you couldn't polyfill. Like, I was frustrated by the sort of black boxedness of CSS. Whereas in the DOM or in JavaScript, they're kind of like soft and malleable, and I could build something that was like almost as good as a real thing with a polyfill. And with CSS, I just absolutely could not do that. And just very much leaning into the comment that I just made before we came to this topic, I wanted people to be able to give us some feedback. And so I reached out through a mailing list, and I ended up talking to Tab Adkins and Boris Zabarsky from Mozilla, like probably hundreds of emails back and forth. And we had sketched out, custom things, a few custom things like custom pseudo classes, custom aliases for pseudos. And I was really excited. Custom Functions got added to the list in Toronto in 2018 or 2019. And then they just kind of like disappeared. I didn't hear anything else about them. So yeah, I'm excited that we're getting somewhere with that.
So like, what's the use case for a custom function?
Polyfilling other functions. or in my mind, also speculatively polyfilling. I really am still a big believer that at some point, if we're to succeed, we need to be able to like make proposals and then give them to people and let them break it and tell us why it doesn't work and show us the better until finally we lay down a cow path and then like we can make it native. I really still think that that's a really positive path forward if we can get there. And so, but I think that this version of custom functions is very specifically limited to something that can do math, right?
It seems that way from reading the specification. That's what's like all, it seems like that's what all of the examples are showing. And just so we're clear, this should really say custom function values, I think, yes, for maximum clarity. So a function value is something like the repeat value in grid, where you say repeat open parenthesis 3 comma 1 FR close parenthesis, and that sets up 3 grid tracks that each has a width of 1 FR. Or calc is a functional value. And this would allow you to make custom functional values, so you could have a value sort of taking from the specification, you could have a custom functional value called add. So it would be dash dash add, and then in parentheses you gave it two numbers, and then the result would be the addition of those two numbers. But it doesn't necessarily have to be numbers. So you can say this function should return a length, this function should return a color. I mean, yeah, I imagine that there could be very, very interesting uses for this. It's just hard to tell how many of them would be possible with this particular specification, like this particular version of it. Because it seems like it's mostly numeric based. And how many times do I want to do math with CSS that I can't do in calc?
I mean, I do think that that's part of the idea, though, is that, you know, in any other programming language, we would build an abstraction around some math, right?
Okay.
And so what are the common abstractions? So like, I don't think that there's probably much of anything that you couldn't technically do with all the math functions that we have created. I think you could do most of them with calc anyway.
A lot of them.
But you know, giving them names and a kind of simple signature allows people to just like put a label on it and recall it and say, oh yeah, that thing. And I don't need to know,
right? You
know, I don't need to know the math involved.
Yeah.
It means we can distribute, you know, a style sheet that you can import.
Right.
Or you can, maybe it can be a mix in your SAS or whatever, you know, like,
yeah, I can see where being able to build your own color functions could be interesting, right? Like trying to do calc based color, it's always a challenge really of deciding how much of this can I, like, do I need to split up? Do I need to have a separate calc for the hue and the this and the that and the other thing? And this would sort of let you just say, I'm going to throw some numbers at this function and then I'm going to get back a color. And however that color was made, it's going to be a full sRGB or HSL or P3 or whatever color it is that it's being returned. So that, you know, that could be interesting. And then, like, beyond custom functions, one of the things I noticed in looking over what's being discussed these days is most things are in app blocks. So, like, at function, blah, 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 blah. And at layer,
sheet,
at sheet, yeah, at layer for specificity layers, you know, obviously at media has been around for a while. We have at support. And then one of the things that's being discussed is scroll based queries, right? They're sort of like media or container queries, except they're for scrolling. which is interesting, being able to do things based on the scroll state, mm-hmm. which, you know, you'd use JavaScript for now, but this would be another app block. And then there was a decision to allow container queries to use the sibling counting functions. So you could basically have a container query that says, at container, blah, blah, blah. You know, at container, if there are more than five descendant elements, apply these styles. Which, okay, interesting.
You know what's really interesting to me is that, so Alice Boxall, who works here now at Egalia, she and I worked on Focus Visible, is what it's called now.
Okay.
But before it was even a official Google thing or whatever, we thought about and wrote like a, you know, speculative polyfill, wrote a blog post about it and everything, modality or something like that. Like it was, and it, like, the idea was like, how are you currently interacting? Are you using the keyboard? Are you using, but it wasn't even as specific as that. It was just sort of like, are you using sequential focus or are you using non-sequential focus, right? So we wrote, I thought, a really nice article for O'Reilly and people were kind of excited about it. And then we were like called up to have a meeting with some people at Google and they said like, but maybe it shouldn't be a at rule because, you know, the thing is when you have an at rule, it, like if you think about all that has to do, like it has to read, like, what are the rules? What are the total set of rules, right? Yeah. And then, like, not just what are the total set of rules, but now, like, sort them in terms of, like, origin and specificity. And then, like, once you have all that, then only can you determine, like, what is relevant to your tree. And you have to do that, like, kind of node by node, you know? So they were like, you, like, it would be kind of a lot if that's happening, like, maybe multiple times as you're interacting with the screen. And I totally get that. Like I think that the solution we came up with is fine, you know, like it's fine. But now I think you can just about do the same thing with the custom properties and the style queries.
Mm.
And absolutely people will, right? And also, like you say, like everything is at rules now. Like we have so many at rules and it's just interesting to me that it's like, let's not do at rule because right. We don't want whole sheets coming in and out of relevance. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things that media queries are doing now. Like you said, scroll state, like mm-hmm. scroll state is going to enable or disable a whole style sheet potentially. Right.
Potentially. Yeah. Yeah. And the having all these app blocks is, I mean, there's more to talk about. What's interesting to me with this one, the counting functions in container queries, is that it actually grew out of a an issue that was opened with a CSS working group that actually asked to disallow the tree counting functions in some contexts. And It was actually disallow mix functions, random functions, and tree counting functions in certain contexts. And at this point in the discussion, the tree counting are actually being allowed in container queries. So that, like I say, you can say, I want to apply if this container has this, you know, some number of children. But yeah, there's more ad blocks coming, seems like, all the time. One of the things that you mentioned was when we were getting ready for the show, one of the things you mentioned was that there's an explainer for anchored container queries.
Yeah. And yesterday, literally yesterday it was
that. Right. And anchored, like anchor positioning has some app blocks in it for like fallbacks and tries. And anyway, and now we've got apparently anchors and container queries. So have you read the explainer? Because I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
I haven't, but I have it. I have a link to it on my screen. I just found it now, like, you know, an hour before the show.
Right.
When we were talking about like, oh, what are we going to talk about? I did a quick, oh, what's this? This just happened yesterday. I didn't even see it. It has to do with like the position try stuff.
Yeah. But yeah, so querying containers that are anchored.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, it says, let's see. There have been multiple requests to support styling of anchored elements based on the chosen position. So like if you are matched at this position at the top, then we need to style tether-like arrows to match the direction of the anchored elements position relative to its anchor. There's a number of GitHub issues linked. It's a way that you would say, if you're anchored like this, or if you're matching the fallback, like basically which one are you matching?
Has the little pop-up showed up above the anchor,
right,
below the anchor, to one side or the other? Is it in a corner? Like, you know, and sure. I mean, that makes sense that you would want to be able to style conditional on where the pop-up or where the thing that's being positioned is positioned with respect to its anchor. So it's we're going to have at rule collapse, basically. There's going to be.
Well, listen to this.
Okay.
Chrome Canary 138.0.7194.0 and later has an experimental implementation of this behind a flag. So, like, we literally just got the explainer added yesterday, and there already is an experimental implementation behind a flag. At least it's behind a flag, and that's good because that means we can go and like not just use our imaginations. We can go and play with it and make sure that we understand. Good.
Yeah. And another chance for people to, you know, bring their use case to it, try it out, see if they can figure out how to make their use case work. And if they can't, then come to the discussion and say, here's what I was trying to do. Here's how I tried to do it. It didn't work. Did I do it wrong? Or is it just not possible? Which is, yeah, like we said, it's a valuable part of this whole process. Yeah, I don't want to spend the entire show on ad blocks.
Well,
there are so many now.
It's a good segue to one of mine was the at sheet, because I just wanted to say that the folks at Microsoft are working on a number of things, and one of those is at sheet,
which is what?
Which is just like a way to put a at rule. You say at sheet, and you can give it like a name, and then that block you can like, it doesn't apply anywhere by default, right? So this was first discussed in I think 2023. There's a proposal. It's issue 11509 on CSS Working Group. It's been open for, you know, since the beginning of this year anyway. And the idea is like, this plays very closely with like the proposals we were talking about earlier in the year. We had Mia on. Maybe it was not this year, probably. We had Mia on. I think that was a good episode. And we talked about like styling in the Shadow DOM, and how that gets really tricky. And also, how do we make it declarative and make it so that you can sort of like import things and say like, hey, these things, I'm pulling them from the outer page, or I have one set of styles that I'm shipping with the outer page for whatever reason, and I want my components to be able to import them. So you can do a lot of this today, but you have to do it imperatively. You have to kind of like polyfill something. You have to sort of make it up, like we did it with some sort of hacking. But this is, I think, an interesting thing. And there's a kind of related thing in HTML that they're also pushing, which is like, to be able to use anchor links on link style sheet, like link rel style sheet, href equals hash something. and it would refer to the name of a style sheet in the page.
So that's sort of what AddSheet helps make possible, although there might be other ways to do it.
It's one of the things that it would
make. Right, possible. So you could say AddSheet shadow styles, and mm-hmm. then have a block of styles, and mm-hmm. then in your shadow DOM thingamajig template, whatever you're mm-hmm. calling them, you can say link rel equals style sheet, href equals octothorpe shadow styles. And mm-hmm. so it kind of reaches up into the parent document and gets that identified at sheet and applies it in its little shadow context. But that you would be.
Well, that's tricky because right. the.
But that's what this proposal talks about doing. And also the thing you were talking about where you could say link rel equals style sheet, href equals, you know, octothorpe sheet 7 or whatever. And then
right.
somewhere you have sort of like an SVG where you have a bunch of definitions of things that you've ID'd, then you can refer to them from other places in the SVG. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like that.
It's a bit of an uncanny valley, though, because like you say href, and it's not really like most other hrefs. Like, we don't have mm-hmm. a way to do that kind of thing exactly. And like mm-hmm. Like the IDs, they don't cross shadow boundaries. For example, if you say document get element by ID, you know, it will only be in that level of the shadow DOM. It won't go down into or anything, right?
Okay.
And so, you know, it's an example of one of those things that we said earlier where, like, if you hold off, if you wait longer, maybe you can make improvements. But then also there's this, like, tension with, like, just shipping the thing. I feel like shadow DOM is one of the things that I wish we would have spent a little bit longer on very early on. In retrospect, at the time, I was like, please, can we just ship it? I feel like we've created a number of problems there. And now we get into all these things that are esoteric and seem a little bit circular. So like we have had, in fact, I made one of them, a proposal for like a sort of like a more global, which is just like, no, I really do mean, like, I want to be able to refer to this anywhere at any level of the shadow DOM, you know, because we, like, globals don't by default do that today, but we could define a new thing. And yeah, I mean, it, you know, we just kind of go in some circles on a few of these things. So it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. And there's all these, like, you know, gotchas in there that the longer we take on it, then things change. Like, so one of the things was very early on, people were like, oh, well, see, every single shadow DOM, like, let's say you have like a custom button and I have like 47 custom buttons on the page. Every single one of those is importing style sheet. They all have their own copy of the style sheet. And so then they link and then they have to reparse the style sheet and then they have to, they're using all the memory and blah, blah, blah. And like, so we need a solution to that. But then a few years later, somebody points out like, but that's not really much of a problem anymore because like we knew that was a problem and we just fixed it. So they like browsers are really good at identifying that that happens and they're not using multiple copies of the memory. Like they do it really fast actually. And then I'll wait a little while longer and somebody says, yeah, but if I mutate one of those, does it mutate all of them? And then if yes, is that a bug or a feature, right? Like, so I don't know. It's fun to watch these things play out. It's also a little bit dizzying. And I think it's one of those things that could use more input.
Yeah. And I mean, that's, yeah, more eyes on any problem is a good thing. And also, you know, someone who's listening to this episode might have listened to the last few minutes saying, yeah, I don't care about Shadow DOM. And that's fine, right?
Yeah, you don't have to.
We're going to move off of that in a minute. But the people who do care about Shadow DOM, like, should absolutely be sort of, like, pushing on this. I think the point I'm trying to get at is you don't have to be in all of these discussions. It's like, find the discussion that really appeals to you, or find the discussion about the thing that you really, really want, or that you really, really think would be the worst thing ever. And get involved in that, you know, that discussion, and don't let other people get involved in the other discussions. So yeah, it would be nice to have more input, more use cases, more have you thought abouts on, for example, AtSheet and these the fragment references and link tags, you know, that sort of thing. There was another one you were talking about, something about pseudo elements.
Yeah. If you don't like Shadow DOM, maybe you like pseudo elements. Actually, Shadow DOM can make a new pseudo element, so you can like both of them. So first, I don't remember why. I was trying to look and see today, just before the show, if I could find where it came from. But CSS pseudo elements level 4 newly defines IDL, which, if you don't know what IDL is, it's like the way that you give a JavaScript DOM shape to something. So what properties does it have? What methods does it have? What do they do? You know, it's so, interface definition language, right? So it's okay. These things that if you scroll through a spec, you'll see something that says, like, you know, oh, this is on the document, or this is on an element, and then here are the properties, here are the methods. And yeah, there's a whole explainer. It's a big thing trying to figure out, and it's linked to lots of other CSS issues that are trying to figure out all of the twists and the turns and gotchas of, okay, so what if we give you a way to access pseudo elements from JavaScript? I mean, like, what is, there are a lot of gotchas in there, right? There are a lot of gotchas and a lot of questions that probably you wouldn't think of anyway, if you didn't write browsers for a living.
Yeah.
And maybe even if you do.
I was literally just going to say.
Yeah.
Because that happens sometimes in these discussions, is someone comes in from completely outside the realm of making browsers and says, so can I do this? And everyone says, no, but you probably should, and we didn't think of that. That never occurred to us. So... yeah, so, you know, having direct JavaScript access to, like, before and after and first letter and first line and custom pseudo elements, if those ever become a thing, that, yeah, I can only imagine what the, actually, I can't even imagine what the sort of constraints and parameters of that would be. And, like, the, you know, if we allow this, what is that going to break?
Yeah, so the basic proposed idea is that you will just say, like, element, big E element, like the element object dot pseudo, and then you pass it like a type before, after, whatever, right? And, you know, like, there's just simple things like, what is that? Like, is it live? Can you change it? If you request it two times in a row, are they, and then you say, is A equal to B? Is it true or not? And, like, to me, I wouldn't actually even have thought of that, even though I am an engineer. I would have been like, why would somebody do that? Like, why does it matter? I would assume it doesn't matter, but there's a lot of conversation about if it should or not. Yeah, so anyway, we'll link to the explainer, and the explainer links to, I don't know, a dozen different issues that are like, what about keyboard handling? Like, what can you have, like, an add event listener on it? What happens if you change this, you know, like?
Yeah, a lot of questions there. I did want to wrap it up with a couple of closely related CSS things. One is a proposal to be able to derive generic shapes from images. So people who have used Shape Outside might know that you can already sort of do this. With Shape Outside for floats, you can point at an image. It could be a PNG, it could be an SVG, it could be a gradient, a CSS gradient. Then say, at a given opacity threshold, that's where I want the edges of this shape to be gotten from. So you can have a big circle, like a simple SVG circle, but then you can say the shape outside should be taken from the, basically the 50% opacity threshold of this circle. And that way you don't have to actually like figure out how to type in the circle definition in your CSS. It just, it's taken from the image. You can also do that with a PNG or I guess with a GIF, but only shape outside can do that at this point. And the idea is, well, how about if we had clip paths or mask paths? Now that we have a more generic shape functional value, can we point at an image and say, get your clip path from that, or get your path, get your shape path from that, whether it's a clip path or a mask path, which I think is kind of interesting. The capability is there. Shape outside already does it. So there's like a path. It's been implemented. Browsers have done it. So this seems like a relatively easy sort of step forward and an easy win to just be able to say that thing that we do for shape outside, we're also going to do it for like clip paths and masking paths. There would be some differences because the those properties do different things. But I find that really interesting.
I do find that very interesting.
But then that brought up the related question of, okay, so if I have an element that I say I want to mask, and I'm going to point at this other, at an image, at this thing to create the mask, and so I'm going to cut out parts of it, what do we do about hit testing? Like the parts of the rectangular element box that have now been masked away, not clipped, but masked. Can you still click on them if it's a link or if it has some sort of event handler? Or can you not? Same thing, you know, with clip paths, you could maybe make an argument that, well, if I've clipped off the corner with this image shape that I've derived, with this shape that I've derived from an image or whatever, that I shouldn't be able to click there. I clipped it, or I shouldn't be able to like handle events in that area. But what about masks? Masks are not necessarily clips. And, you know, for that matter, shapes, shape outside kind of shapes. Should you be able to click on the thing? Like, should you bubble an event? And that's still being discussed. It's not clear because there, you know, that then leads into questions like, okay, so at what value of the opacity property does a thing suddenly not hit test anymore? Is it only zero? If I have opacity 0.00000001, will that handle events? And if so, can I then clickjack a site by injecting a thing that just draws a big hyperlink that fills the entire viewport and has an opacity of 0.00001, so no human can perceive it. But when you try to click on something on the page, then it gets intercepted.
Right.
So should there be some sort of like perceivable threshold? And those are questions that have been largely deferred until now when it comes to things like opacity, but they're being re-brought up because if you're deriving a mask from an image, that image might not be simply, you know, opaque or transparent, right? You could be getting it from a gradient image, and so it blends from opacity 0 to opacity 1. And so at what point does clicking not work anymore? Or does, you know, and those are... those are open questions right now, but it's an interesting sort of conjunction of, okay, let's grab things from images. And an image can be, like I said, it can be a linear gradient. And if I have my linear gradient go from transparent black to fully opaque black, and then I use that as the masking path or the masking thing for this other element, what effect does that have on hit testing? And there are a lot of opinions.
I don't want to hijack this, but like...
well, you can clickjack it. It's fine.
It made me think, is the problem... that I should know the answer to this, but I don't. But like the problem that you describe, what happens today if I just like say, okay, like, give me a new, you know, top Z index, and it's just transparent, but put a click handler on it, and anything that you click, I'm just gonna take it, you know.
Yeah, the last time I checked, and it's been a while, I think it was anything above opacity zero could register events. But like I said, that may have changed.
This is already a problem then.
Sure. It's already a problem. It was sort of the, it's the mathematically easiest thing to do. Right.
Right.
If it's zero, then nothing. And if it's anything other than zero, then yes. That actually brings up an interesting question. If you're going to restrict the hit testing based on the mask or the clip, what are the accessibility implications on things like form elements? That's interesting too. Or whatever. So, yeah. Anyway. But yeah, there's a lot of questions there. So, yeah. Again, if you're interested in this or any of these other conversations, dive down one of the rabbit holes we'll have in the show links and participate in the conversation, please.
Yeah. And all these were, I know at the beginning of the show you said, like, you know, yours are going to be all CSS and mine will be wider. The only one of mine that's wider is the one in HTML that is about a style sheet link. So it's really still about CSS, but we could maybe think about doing a future show that is wider, because there are lots of other things that are developing that are also pretty interesting to watch. Yeah. And they also could use more participation. So
yeah,
maybe look for that in a future show.
Yep. All right. Cool beans. Good talking to you, Brian.
Thanks, Eric.